from NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. Coming up, federal prosecutors prepared to rest their case against admitted Boston Marathon bomber Jahar Tsarnaev.
But first, investigators continue to look for more information on Andreas Lubitz, the German Wings co-pilot who's been accused of intentionally crashing that airliner into the French Alps earlier this week, killing 150 people. Jason Bellini of the Wall Street Journal is following the story and joins us now. And Jason, we don't know more about his motivation at this point, but what's the latest that investigators do know about Lubitz?
Well, you're right. We don't know his motive for crashing the plane, as the prosecutors say very definitively he did. You know, we were talking to people who knew him, and it's still really a mystery what the situation was. They say he was quiet, he was pleasant, he was a responsible person. And Lufthansa saying they had no indication that he would, you know, that there was any indication that he would deliberately crash an aircraft. And, you know, people who saw him recently also said, you know, he didn't seem burdened. So there's no clues that have come up yet. Now, the biggest question is as this medical letter that prosecutors revealed today, he concealed from his employer, from Lufthansa, and apparently he took this letter and tore it up. That would have excused
a doctor's
him
note
from
is
working
what you're
that
talking
day.
About,
a doctor's note, exactly. Yeah, the doctor's note. Now, the key question that has not been answered today, and hopefully we'll know soon, is was this a physical condition or was it a mental condition? The prosecutor would not reveal that. There's a lot of sensitivity, especially in Europe, when it comes to privacy.
Well, what do we know about his mental health, though?
Very little. I mean, what we can say is that CNN's reporting that they have heard from the university clinic where the doctor who wrote the note worked, who said that he was not treated for depression. Again, this is what CNN is reporting, that the university clinic cautioned them, said, hey, he's not being treated for depression. So beyond that, we don't know. All we know is that there have been a medical file that on him and he has an ongoing medical issue. What that was remains a secret to us at the moment.
And unlike the Egypt Air crash in which the pilot deliberately crashed the plane, this was back in 1999, it does
right.
not appear at this point like religion played any factor in this, right?
Right. And the prosecutor said that they did not uncover a suicide note or any indication of a political or religious motive for his apparent decision to crash the plane.
What about Lufthansa? How frequently are they doing evaluations of their pilots on things like mental or physical health conditions?
Well, you know, the airline says that says that they don't actually keep on site their own mental health files on their people, that those go with the doctors, and they have a formal review underway now, you know, about whether they need to change the way that they evaluate their pilots. But, you know, there's a certification process, a recertification process that is at the government level, and that's what they rely upon.
Jason, it is being reported that Lubitz did have a girlfriend. Do we know anything about her or their relationship?
It's amazing. With so many reporters swarming right now, his community to find out details on him, even that hasn't been established firmly. It's unclear if she's his wife or his girlfriend. He has been seen, according to neighbors, accompanied by a woman frequently when he'd be walking around the neighborhood in his uniform. And the neighbors describe him as being really shy. But again, you know, we don't know whether he was married. And the mayor of the town would decline to divulge to the Wall Street Journal whether he was married, what his date of birth was. They're not thrilled to have all of this attention on them and are being very close-lipped about him.
Well, we also know that there was a break in his flight training about a year after it began in 2008. Are there more details on that?
I apologize that the captain.
No, that's fine. I mean, look, that it's
is
a new story.
There,
yeah.
too. Yeah. Yeah. The gap lasted. What we do know is that the gap lasted for a number of months. This was according to Lufthansa's chief executive, but that there was no indication of burnout or any other mental problem concerning him is what they're saying right now. So what? But why was it? Why did he step away from his training? What was the reason? We don't know.
Well, one thing we do know is that the airline official in Europe are looking into how they might prevent something like this in the future. Lufthansa even today saying that it's going to have two pilots in the cockpit or at least two people in the cockpit at all times, right?
Oh, that's right. Not just in Europe. I mean, very quickly, airlines and regulatory authorities around the globe are changing their rules. But the EU specifically is considering introducing rules that would require airlines to have two crew members, the rules that have been in place in the U.S. since 9/11.
Jason Bellini of the Wall Street Journal with the latest on what we know and what we don't know at this point about
so much we don't know.
Exactly, about the German Wings crash. What we do know is that Andreas Lubitz is being accused of intentionally crashing that airliner into the French Alps, killed 150 people in that crash. Jason, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Federal prosecutors are preparing to rest their case against Johar Tsarnaev in the Boston Marathon bombing trial early next week. As they wrap up, they're calling medical examiners to the stand to testify about the deaths of three people right near the finish line of the marathon. And to reinforce their point, the prosecution has put full-scale replicas of the bombs in the hands of the jurors. David Boeri from Here and Now contributor WBUR has been in the courtroom throughout the proceedings and has this report.
Edward Knapp is the kind of guy you want for a bomb technician. He never makes a sudden move. His voice never rises from a flat monotone. A former Navy SEAL, the FBI agent took the stand on day 14 of testimony as the prosecution comes full circle to rest its case where it began, with the bombings. "Pressure cookers, I seen those," said Knapp. He led the reconstruction of bombs from hundreds and thousands of bits and pieces after the explosion near the finish line that killed three and injured 260 people. "Did you reach a conclusion about what happened?" asked the prosecutor. "Yeah. There were two devices, the pressure cookers. Two bombs that were carried in there and backpacks that went off. They had electrical fusing systems." The technicians figured out that 6-quart pressure cookers had been filled with 8 to 16 pounds of pyrotechnic powder, like that in fireworks. In a show-and-tell to attentive jurors, Knapp explained that you can't have a bomb without a detonator. And in these bombs, the detonator planted into the explosive powder was a small Christmas tree bulb from a string of lights. Prosecutors say the accused Islamic jihadists, defendant Johar Tsarnaev and his brother Tamerlan, who died in a later shootout, triggered the bulb with the same controls hobbyists use to drive toy cars by remote control. Evidence at trial has shown that Tamerlan purchased a toy blue monster rally truck in February 2013. According to Agent Knapp, the Tsarnaevs rigged the toy's transmitter and receiver so they could transmit an electric signal to light the filament in the Christmas bulb and blow up the bombs. Dryly, the agent referred to added fragmentation. By that, he meant the small nails and BBs glued inside the pressure cookers that made them anti-personnel devices designed to injure, maim, and kill. Both repulsed and attracted, the jurors handled the mock-up bombs. They measured their weight and examined the contents. The juror, who works as a restaurant manager, passed it to the dress designer, who passed it to the legal secretary, who passed it to the woman juror who wears Led Zeppelin and Pink Floyd hoodies to court. These bombs may have been mock-ups, but after 14 days of testimony, the jurors knew the effects were not theoretical. Then came the first of three medical examiners, Dr. Jennifer Hammers, to present the jury with autopsy photos. The atmosphere turned grim. Clinically, Dr. Hammers delivered a long presentation of the many injuries, from deep 10-inch wounds to stippling and burns that killed Crystal Marie Campbell, a 29-year-old from nearby Arlington. The judge had warned the jurors the photos were vivid, but that did not stop the distress provoked by the appearance of Campbell's body on the jurors' screens. The restaurant manager wiped her eyes. The dress designer's face went taut, and she bit her lower lip. The legal secretary removed her glasses. Next came the exhibits in small bags stained red, identified by the witness as swabs, pieces of shrapnel, and multiple pellets removed from Campbell's body. The defense has attempted to establish that it's the older brother, Tamerlan, who was the lead agent in the bombings and the shootings and mayhem. It presents its defendant, Johar, as a mere follower, and yesterday used cross-examination to make strong points that Tamerlan had purchased the remote-controlled cars, that explosive powders had only been found in Tamerlan's apartment and in Tamerlan's car, not in Jahar's dorm room at UMass Dartmouth, and that someone's fingerprints were found on bomb fragments other than Jahar's. But those points paled in comparison to the horror evident among the jurors at the end of the day. after seeing photos of people blown up by the actions of not just the dead brother, but the defendant as well, who has admitted in the words of his attorney, Judith Clark, it was him. How long did it take Crystal Campbell to die? Asked prosecutor William Weinreb. Up to a minute, Dr. Hammers, the medical examiner, answered. The horror was complete for the day. On Monday, the prosecution plans to call two more medical examiners to testify about the two other deaths, and then rest its case, to be followed by testimony for the defense. For Here and Now, I'm David Boeri at the Federal Courthouse in Boston.
Birkenstocks are back, which has got to be good music to the ears of Birkenstock executives. The venerable German footwear maker is trying to reach a new customer base by updating its mildly boring design by using trendy colors, leather insoles, and what else but faux fur nicknamed Firkenstocks. Journalist Rebecca Mee took a closer look at Birks for this week's New Yorker magazine. She traveled to Birkenstock headquarters outside Dresden, Germany. Rebecca, what did you learn about this company that began with an actual Mr. Birkenstock?
Well, going way back to the 1700s, there was a cobbler named Birkenstock who made shoes. He wasn't making sandals yet. But in the late 19th century, there was a Birkenstock family, and they were making shoes. And their innovation was to create shoes that had an insole that was shaped to fit the foot. At the time, your insole was typically just a flat piece of leather. It wasn't until the 1960s that one of the descendants, a man called Carl Birkenstock, invented the idea of blending cork and latex together to make the very recognizable, iconic Birkenstock sole, and then to put straps on that to hold it onto the foot. Initially, it was supposed to be an exercise sandal. The idea was that you gripped onto it with your feet and that kind of toned your leg. There's a wonderful German word, angst reflex, which means fear reflex. And that's the fear reflex that you have, that your foot is going to, the shoe is going to fall off your foot if you don't hold on to it with your toe.
Yes, the Germans have all the good words like that. And so then ultimately, how did they change the style?
Well, you know, he created this exercise sandal in the 1960s and then gradually introduced a few more styles and brands, and it grew. Really, a very important factor in the expansion of the company was an American or a German woman by origin, but she moved to America, a woman called Margot Fraser. And in the 1960s, she was back in Germany. She tried on a pair of these shoes because her feet hurt. She found them in a local store and loved them and started importing them to the United States. And that helped to propel Birkenstock from being a sort of small orthopedic company in Germany to being something much, much larger.
So how is the company keeping up with trends? Or actually, I wonder, it's kind of a trend in and of itself. Does it pay much attention to what's happening in footwear internationally?
Since 2013, there's a new CEO. There are two CEOs at the company, actually. And what he told me is that they're not interested in following fashion cycles and sort of a fashion enthusiasm for the shoe, that what they want and what they're getting is a kind of steady growth rather than everybody's wearing them this year because Miley Cyrus is wearing them and then nobody's wearing them next year because she's throwing them out and replaced them with something else. And what they're doing now with the brand is making very slight tweaks and changes while retaining the core, as they would say, DNA of the brand, which is this cork and latex footbed, doing things like introducing the fur, introducing new colors, new textures, just a slight change. But the other big thing that they're doing is they are finally making shoes and boots that feel inside like a Birkenstock when you're wearing them, but look from the outside not like an orthopedic shoe, but like a, you know, like a decent, fashionable, comfortable, attractive shoe.
And you tried them on?
I tried on a lace-up boot that is lined with fur. And when I put it on, I never wanted to take it off. I know I sound like I'm advertising for them, but I just love this thing.
All right. Now, here's the question. Socks. Do they require socks when you wear the boots? Because, you know, we know that the ultimate Birkenstock wearer wears them with socks for the complete geeky orthopedic look. So how about with the boots?
Well, these boots, the ones that are lined with fur, they told me that, you know, if you have the fur insole as well, you can wear them without socks.
And Birkenstocks, according to your article, is actually getting into the sock business. Is that right?
They are. They are going to start the whole range of socks, and they'll be selling them in some stores this coming fall. Some of them are sort of tweedy or textured or marled or, you know, cable knit and kind of a nice feel to them. I also saw a couple of things that were done, I think, more for show than for anything else. There was one that was a cashmere, more than a sock, it was really a stocking. It had a garter attached to it. So it was sort of like a cable knit sweater for your whole leg. I thought that it was suitable only perhaps for a bride in Lapland.
Yes. By the way, when you mentioned the Boston mule style shoe, Birkenstock shoe, and then there's the traditional Arizona sandal, how much do American tastes influence what Birkenstock as a company manufactures?
Well, it's a big market, so they are an important influence. There are other important influences too. Japan's a very big market. They're very, very popular in Japan. One of the things that Americans like more than Germans is a soft footbed. In America, we tend to think that softness equals comfort. And so Birkenstock makes a kind of a footbed that's cushioned. The Germans are a hardier people, and they tend to think that your feet should be on a hard surface. And while I was in Germany talking to people from Birkenstock, there was a certain amount of raised eyebrows about all the Americans. They like their soft footbed, like, you know, like a sort of pillow top mattress.
Yeah, they have us pegged, you know.
Right, exactly. Yeah, they know what they're doing.
And what about the product itself? Is it still entirely made in Germany?
It is. The company's headquarters are in the west of Germany near Bonn, but the factories are all over Germany. And one of the main ones, and the one that I visited, is in a town in the east near Dresden called Görlitz. It's right on the border with Poland. But as of now, everything is made in Germany. And they're very proud of that fact. You know, that way they can keep control of quality and, you know, in ways that they just couldn't do if they were manufacturing everything in China.
I have one more question about your visit to the headquarters itself. I mean, thinking of this company, which is so much an anti-fashionable piece of fashion wear, did anything defy your expectations about your visit, either the headquarters itself, the way people, what people wore there? Did they all wear Birks?
They did, yes. The CEO of the company was wearing these fur Arizonas, the fur sandals, and he was wearing them with bare feet. I was there on a very rainy, cold day in December. I was wearing kind of warm boots, and he sort of laughed in the face of my cold feet and said he was completely fine with these. And until it dropped below freezing, he would be going barefoot in his furry sandals. But the whole place is, you know, it's very sleek, little seating area with cork seats so that it is reminiscent of the cork of the brand. I mean, they're very, very much on message.
Rebecca Mead of The New Yorker talking about the German shoe company Birkenstock. Her article in the current issue of The New Yorker is going to be on our website, hereandnow.org. Nice to speak to you, Rebecca.
Great. Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
I don't know. I'm not really. I've never been a Birkenstock person, Lisa.
It speaks well of you. Yeah,
well, the late comedian George Carlin, who I don't think was either, made his mark, of course, with words. But as of today, his picture also hangs in the Smithsonian's National Portrait Gallery. Fans selected him over Groucho Marx and Ellen DeGeneres as the comedian who most influenced American life. We remember Carlin's seven words you can never say on television led to his 1972 arrest on obscenity charges. And he was known for some things that we can't play on the radio, but also some things that we can.
Fine and dandy. That's an old-fashioned one, isn't it? Yeah. Say to a guy, how are you? He says, fine and dandy. Not me. I never say that. You know how come? Because I'm never both of those things at the same time. Sometimes I'm fine, not dandy. Close to dandy. Approaching dandy. In the vicinity of dandyhood. Not quite fully dandy. Other times, I am indeed highly dandy. However, not fine. One time, 1965, August, for about an hour, I was both fine and dandy at the same time. but nobody asked me how I was.
Well, as the Smithsonian honors George Carlin, the Library of Congress is adding 25 recordings to its national registry. They include Arthur Godfrey's radio coverage of President Franklin Roosevelt's funeral in 1945, as well as these.
So darling, darling, stand by me. Oh, stand by me. Oh, stand. Stand by me.
Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the night on fire.
So were you able to name all those tunes? That was Lauryn Hill's Doo-Wop, That Thing. Before that, Paranoid Android from Radiohead, Stand By Me by Ben E. King, The Doors, Light My Fire, and Black Snake Moan by Blind Lemon Jefferson. That was from 1928. You can see the full list of recordings that are being added to the Library of Congress National Recording Registry at hereandnow.org. This is Here and Now. The price of Brent crude oil jumped this week as Saudi Arabia began airstrikes in Yemen. Yesterday saw the biggest spike in oil prices since February. The growing conflict in Yemen between the government and rebels has stoked fears of further instability in the oil market. And joining us to talk about that is Mike Regan of Bloomberg News. Mike, Yemen is not even a big oil producer. Why is this impacting the market so much?
Well, whenever there is violence like this flaring up in the Middle East, the obvious concern is that it could escalate very quickly. And as part of the fighting, either production of oil or shipping routes could be disrupted. And in this case, Yemen lies along the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, which is the fourth busiest oil and shipping bottleneck in the world. So the concern would be that if these rebels could actually somehow disrupt that strait, the supplies from Saudi Arabia could potentially be disrupted.
But even if they did, fundamentally, we still have the same situation, which is there's a glut of oil on the market because places like the United States are flooding it with so much oil and natural gas. Why would this have such an impact given that?
Well, you know, it looks today, you know, oil's back down today, so it looks like it probably was a little bit of an overreaction. That said, with oil as low as it is, under $50 a barrel, under $60 a barrel for Brent crude, obviously there are it's not necessarily just a supply and demand dynamic. There are obviously speculators in the market who can sort of exaggerate moves to the upside or the downside. So in this case, you know, with oil under 50 bucks in the U.S., it's likely that, you know, people are looking for any reason to sort of jump back in and bid the price back up. And that could have been part of what's going on here.
Meanwhile, some of the other big oil producing countries, Iran and Russia, have called on Saudi Arabia to stop the airstrikes in Yemen. Iran, as we know, is backing the Houthi rebels there in Yemen. What kind of risk is there for a bigger geopolitical flare-up that would have a bigger impact on the oil markets?
Well, obviously, the main concern would be continued exaggerated tensions between the Sunni and Shia factions of Islam in the Middle East. You know, the Saudi Arabians are Sunnis. Iran is Shia.
Right.
And the rebels are Shias. So, you know, obviously that's, you know, a conflict that's been raging for years. And the concern, the main sort of immediate concern is we quoted a consulting firm called Stratfor that said, you know, the one thing they would worry about is rebels from Yemen could carry out sort of cross-border attacks into Saudi Arabia and possibly seize the long-range ballistic missiles from Yemen's army. And that's sort of the main immediate concern with this.
Now, there is there have been many, many months now of very, very low oil prices, at least historically, and gas prices people have been noticing. Is that likely to continue for a while? Is that what people are expecting?
You know, we do a tally of professional forecasters who try to estimate where they predict oil will average for each quarter. What they're predicting right now is sort of a slow but steady increase, but nothing that would get it back to the levels above $100 a barrel last year. The average forecast right now is for less than 58 by the end of this year for West Texas oil and about $60.30 for the end of next year. That said, it's a very hard thing to predict. The estimates at the beginning of last year ended up being way off, so it's really anybody's guess.
Mike Regan of Bloomberg News. Sounds like we'll have some low gas prices for a while. Mike, thanks.
Thank you.
Alyssa Quart is a journalist, author, and critic who's captivated by culture and commerce. She's followed the transition of cities such as New York through gentrification and financial meltdown. In fact, her creativity is fed by the world of marketing, branding, and commercialism.
I'm obsessed with it. I don't know when that started. I think as a kid, I loved signs for restaurants. At that point, right, it might be neon signs for restaurants or Howard Johnson's. I was fascinated by jingles. And when I got a little older, I was really interested in photography of signs like Walker Evans. So I guess I'm a critic of commercial culture, but I'm also kind of an aficionado. So it's a double thing because I think there's a lot of strange beauty in the language of commerce.
Alyssa Quart has now turned the language and the impact of commerce into poetry. She has just released her first book of poems that are both personal and universal. The book is called Monetized. It's a form of civic poetry, a form that addresses issues of class and gender and the environment. We asked Alyssa Quart to read and tell us about part of a poem that she calls Views.
So that was a poem about gentrification in New York, actually.
Yes.
So this is sort of Brooklyn. This is quite old. I think it's probably 10 years, 11 years old. And I remember watching these young women in, I guess it was what's now probably, you know, some part of Park Slope or something. But
the women with the liquid paper arms.
Liquid paper arms disappearing and photoshopping and the buildings becoming luxury cubes, taking the space of the lower middle class and not noticing the tattooed torso that's going to be taking their home at some point.
But you noticed. Yeah. I mean, you grew up in New York.
Yeah.
You're a real city girl.
Yeah, exactly. So I did notice, and I biked around Brooklyn a lot in that period, I guess, and I was constantly trying to look at these signs of gentrification. So it's called Views. Anorexic transplant flashes skin at fashion sisters, liquid paper arms, vanishing anesthetic. Home is a lead-painted hut. An occupational art therapist made luxury cubes. She photoshopped. A liberal arts stripper silver-collared herself, a souvenir to man's bad taste. And then later, these are the lower middle's unlovely places, all named as paradises. Sunset Park, Neptune Avenue, Midwood, elm-shaded mother-daughter houses, managerial class fear of falling, surge-suited, a strollered citizens' brigade, Saturday evening post-its. They do not notice a man's tattooed torso, an ice cream cake falling into mortification as ceremony turns mourning to nostalgia, and villains and cities go on.
So give us another example of what you've observed as a part of your civic poetry.
So I went to Fort Lauderdale to a book festival, and it was funny. It's always quite humdrum, right? But I was there on spring break, and I was thinking about Easter and the Ascension, and it really had this kind of like Sodom and Gomorrah aspect. It was, as I describe it, day glow and people wheeling around half drunk at, you know, 10 in the morning, and, you know, older people too. And then all these yachts just like sitting on the docks like carcasses, because this was after the crash in 2009 or 10. I don't remember which. And I just was like, wow, I really want to write about what this moment feels like. So it's called Spring Breaks. Can we refuse ourselves, millennial bland angels, tectonically tapping our sweat-free abalone blouses, signatured water, neon-hearted? Let us be shielded here where the knots end, unnoticed, where yachts hope, shiningly unbought, all owners at risk, all trying to float.
You know, again, as we follow the chronology of our world, of New York City, of our economy, we're also following the chronology of your life. And you write very personally about changes in your own life, including when you became a mother. How long ago was that?
Yeah, I had my daughter 4 years ago, and it was a shock, as it is for many women who have kids. You know, it wasn't super late, but it was relatively late. And I was interested in writing. I mean, some of these poems are about the inner experience of feeling the thing that you spent most of your life doing, thinking and writing, is now been utterly replaced. And having, again, you know, complicated feelings about that and trying to figure out who you are. And also, I was thinking about the motherhood penalty, which is something a lot of women experience in the workplace, where they're not they're not hired with the same frequency or for the same amount as women without children, and of course as men. So that kind of influenced my thinking and my poetry as well. I mean, most of this book is very much through the prism of the journalism I've been doing. Yeah. So Green Fairy was a poem I wrote when I was pregnant, wanting to feel the joy that you're supposed to feel when you're pregnant. I felt it obviously later when, I mean, I feel it now very much, but I didn't then. So this is a kind of a dark fairy tale pregnancy. I was sick for a lot of it too, so that's part of it. The unborn filters sweets, steals bones, peels teeth, dines on fingernails. So a breakfast must be eaten, hand sanitized. And then later, where's the sweet lacquer around me? The Necco candy mother's coating I'd been promised. This maternity oxidizes on contact, acrid, residual, silver polish. But mothers should be base, not acid. Make cows, solve. Fairy books warned of cruel queens. A line of mothers, hands lanced.
Oh, that's painful. But things got better, thankfully.
Yeah. I mean, it was a difficult pregnancy, basically, that I hadn't expected.
Right.
Everyone was so joyful and everyone was, you'll feel better. And I was ill the whole time. And it was not. Yeah.
And then thinking that the unborn, as you say, filters sweets, steals bones, because you can get osteoporosis, I guess, or your bones weaken when you're pregnant, et cetera.
Yeah.
And then maybe if you can take us to the other side of that, after you gave birth.
Yeah. So I had my daughter and it was quite beautiful, but it was still confusing. I was still sort of in the experience of raising her more than, you know, my own mind. So this is a line from that. Like babies, their mothers may only see small pieces, close-ups, an exquisite corpse, meaning the figure won't cohere, only toes, hands, no body we understand. Baby says circles go on top of each other. All work is women's work. So, I mean, that's kind of me arguing with myself about what labor is, I guess, while I'm caring for her, which, you know, reflected a lot of what my journalism was about and is about. It's not just personal, it's sort of professional also.
I wonder if you can compare the experience of writing your nonfiction books to the experience of writing your first book of poetry.
Well, you know, I was always writing poetry on the side. I mean, that's part of the title, Monetized. It's kind of an ironic title because, you know, as Robert Graves said, there's no money in poetry, but then there's no poetry in money either, which I actually, and I felt like this book is a response to that, because I think there is poetry in money, but there is no money in poetry. So
you don't know yet. The book just came out.
Yeah, when it's adapted by Scott Rudin, I'll call you. But, it was a ironic title in certain ways, but then it's not, because it's also about that experience of being monetized. So, I mean, I saw the poetry as like a space that I could go to that, where language was not obviously, it was not paid by the word. I mean, literally.
Paid by the piece? Paid by the poem?
Poetry is unpaid. One poetry critic calls poetry negative economics, which I always love that. It's sort of like a wonderful. I think poetry was sort of the form that now many arts are following in its wake, right? Everyone's doing everything because they love it, man, you know, because there's no, or, oh, because it's going to lead to something else. But so poetry is always this space of love.
Alyssa Court, thank you. Really nice to talk to you. And by the way, is today your birthday?
It's my birthday.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Harris County commissioners in Texas will receive a plan next week to renovate and save the Houston Astrodome, a building that some people called the eighth wonder of the world when it opened in 1965.
The shape of things to come in our national sport as the baseball season gets underway. The spanking new Astrodome is the new $31 million home of the Houston Astros, a domed stadium that holds nearly 50,000 for a baseball game and more for conventions and meetings.
But time caught up with the Astrodome. It's gone mostly unused since 1999 when the Astros found a new home. And Harris County has been struggling to decide whether to save it or tear it down. The latest proposal to keep the dome alive was led by Wayne Ratkovich for the Urban Land Institute. The report essentially says the building is too historic to tear down. And Wayne, it seems like the big question always asked is, why is an empty sports venue built in the 1960s so important?
Most of the folks who answer that respond by talking about baseball, because baseball is really what triggered the whole concept of the Astrodome. Houston was growing into a major city. Major League Baseball was expanding. Houston wanted baseball. The weather in Houston in the summertime, as everybody knows, is not conducive to baseball. So the idea was, quite creatively, to construct an enclosed dome in which baseball could be played. That was an engineering feat. It was a feat of enormous civic entrepreneurship and enterprise and cooperation. It was a great achievement for the city. So that in itself, I think, was a significant moment when they created the first indoor stadium.
But this is an awfully big building to keep around when it's not being used for what it was built for, just to keep that history alive, isn't it?
Yes, it is a big building, and it would be another very ambitious feat by the city of Houston to make this work.
Well, tell us what you want to do exactly.
Well, start with the fact that the dome is part of NRG Park, and NRG Park has three major enterprises adjacent to the dome. One is an NFL stadium where the professional football is now played. They have an international trade center that is right next to the dome. And most significantly is the Houston Livestock and Rodeo Show, which is an enormous event in Houston. Part of what we suggested was not just to improve the Astrodome, but it was to improve all of NRG Park. It is a pretty stark, barren area right now, with parking for 26,000 cars. So we're suggesting that there be an improved connection to public transit, that there be significant landscape improvements so that the arrival to NRG Park is a much more pleasant experience than it currently is. When one arrives at the Astrodome, you can enter it slightly above grade level. And on that main floor, a new main floor that doesn't exist today, would be the great meeting place for pregame activities for the NFL, for the Houston Livestock and Radio Show for their activities, for trade shows to be conducted by the International Trade Conference that takes place there. So there is a grand open space on the ground floor with pavilions that would, for example, follow the trace of baseball. It would follow the history of space, of technology, of medicine, all things that Houston has good reason to be very proud of.
Now, the price tag for your plan is more than $240 million, and it calls for a mix of public and private money. But voters have already said they're not willing to foot the bill for a renovation project. There was a bond issue that failed back in 2013. How could you make this work this time around? How could you get Houstonians behind you on this?
I think the answer, Jeremy, is a compelling story. And there is a compelling story associated with this building. I think the people who were the supporters of the prior bond issue, by their own admission, said it wasn't as good an effort as we should have made. I think the possibility now exists. If Houstonians really like the idea that we've come up with and that there is both public and private support for it, this time around, we believe it has a chance of succeeding.
One critic of your plan wrote in the Houston Chronicle that your vision doesn't go big enough, that Houston should be talking about something on the scale of one of the major cultural icons in New York or Chicago. What do you think about that?
I think it'd be wonderful for the city of Houston to be as ambitious as they want to be with this site. I think fixing the dome is ambitious enough for right now. And if they can do that, that will be a great achievement.
If this does not work out, what happens? Does the dome get torn down, or what are you expecting?
That's probably the fate if things don't work. I think if we stimulate in the city of Houston an all-out effort to make this plan or some version of it work successfully, that would be a wonderful outcome. And if that effort fails, then at least a major effort has been made to save the building, and the consequence of that will be pretty obvious. It didn't work.
Wayne Ratkovich chaired a report by the Urban Land Institute on a plan to renovate and save Houston's Astrodome. We'll link you to his plan at our website, hereandnow.org. Wayne, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed it.
Back to Houston, Houston, Houston.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Lisa Mullins in for Robin Young. This is Here and Now.